Welcome to Global Minnesota Podcasts, connecting, informing, and engaging Minnesotans with the world and exploring important international issues. For a complete list of programs and to join us, visit globalminnesota.org.
Topic tonight is energy and geopolitics of energy, or energy and foreign policy, U.S. foreign policy. Energy, of course, is something we all use. It's central to the fabric of the way we lead our lives, to how we travel, what we eat, in our homes, in our work, really in everything. There's a conversation that one can have, or we could have, or it could be part of this conversation, about whether that reliance that we have on energy is a good thing, how happy we are about oil and gas and some of the bad things that they bring, or whether we should change our carbon footprint and live in a more environmentally friendly way. Some of you will have perspectives on that you might want to share, and undoubtedly know more about those issues than I do. And so I hope that can be part of our discussion. My remarks will focus on some of the things that are happening in the political economy of global energy and some of the ways in which energy intersects with U.S. foreign policy.
This works?
Yes. So I want to start with what some observers call an energy revolution. Sweeping changes that are ongoing and arguably still accelerating in the demand, in the supply of energy, in the demand for energy, in technology and renewables related to the energy sector, and in the trade pattern, the patterns of global trade and energy. And they're all very much related to the geopolitics and political issues that arise in this area for the United States. Let me start with supply. I look around the room. Most people in this room, old enough to remember the shock of the 1973-74 Arab oil boycott. That marked a change from an era of cheap gasoline. For those of us who are a little bit older, cheap gasoline in the 1950s and 60s. The episode made us aware, made Americans aware of the way they hadn't been before, of the limits that we face, of the idea that our world and its resources are at some point, at least in principle, finite. Our outlook, or the way that I think people then came to regard energy, was focused on scarcity and on our growing dependence on foreign sources. And that those were going to be both things that would kind of dominate, or very, at least heavily influence, the way we look at energy in the world and energy as it pertains to American interests. In the last decade, a newfound abundance kind of snuck up. New oil and gas has come on stream all over the world, led by a radical increase in this country. U.S. oil output nearly doubled in the years since 2008, putting us back in the ranks of the top producers in the world of oil. This has translated, for example, in a reduction in oil imports from about 60% of American oil consumption in 2006. To just under one quarter today. If anybody had asked me in 1990 or 1995 or even in 2000, would we ever be in a situation where only 20% of our oil comes from foreign sources, I would have said you're nuts. This is a huge change. The output of natural gas in the United States over the same period was at 35%, making us the world's largest producer of natural gas. And most experts who look at the U.S. gas sector say that growth is almost certainly going to increase in the years and decades to come. Whereas only 12 or so years ago, we were planning to import liquefied natural gas, we recently began to export liquefied natural gas. And in December 2015, Congress lifted the ban on crude oil sales out of this country that had been in existence for 40 years. This burst of production has not really happened because of great big new discoveries or because of changes in U.S. policy. The drivers are the market, entrepreneurship, plus some technologies. Horizontal drilling, hydraulic fracturing or fracking, And the application of information and a whole variety of other new technologies to the oil and gas business. Fracking, of course, leads to some concerns about groundwater quality, about earthquakes where they didn't used to belong. Be those concerns as it may, these new techniques have significantly lowered production costs, increased rates of recovery, made economical fields in here that were never economical before. Think North Dakota, for example. Our oil and gas, the oil and gas revolution in this country has been bolstered by increased output in Canada, which has doubled its oil production since 2000 and is now the single largest source of American imported oil, not Saudi Arabia, Canada, and Mexico, the third largest source of imported American oil. Those two countries, plus a long list of other non-OPEC, non-Arab countries, have also increased their output, radically changing the energy landscape in the direction of something more akin to abundance than scarcity. Think $50, $60 a barrel versus, say, $125, which was the figure only a few years ago. And many people at that time talked about $150, $200. Who knew how high it would go? The pattern of change on the supply side is matched on the demand side. The International Energy Agency, or IEA, projects that global demand for energy, for all forms of energy, will increase something like 30% over the next 22 years, but in very different ways in different parts of the world. In the developed world, demand for oil is declining virtually everywhere. American and European Union consumption of oil has fallen by over 10% from their respective peaks, both of which were in 2006. Japan's oil or energy consumption peaked in 2004. The IEA projects that in the next two decades, oil consumption will decline annually by 1% in the United States, 1.7% in the EU, and 2.4% in Japan. You add those annual declines and the power of compounding, I didn't do the math, but it's a big number, big change. On a macro level, this owes to low rates of growth, to efficiency gains, and renewables, all of which suggest that the developed world, which consumed over half of the world's energy until 2006, will never return to that kind of dominance, if you will, in a pattern of demand. The developing world looks quite different. IEA research suggests that nearly all of the growth in global consumption in the next 20 years will be in that part of the world. Demand will double in Asia, it will double in Africa, it will double in the Middle East. The biggest driver will be China, already the world's largest importer of oil. Think about that, already the world's largest importer of oil, the third largest importer of liquefied natural gas. China will overtake the United States as the largest consumer of energy in the world in the early 2030s. India is also moving up the consumption ladder, if you want to call it that. Its electricity output, for example, is projected to more than triple over the next 22 years. Triple, as the country struggles to bring electric power to the hundreds of millions of its citizens that don't have any at all. The largest share of that energy output in or electricity production in India, coal. Think about what that huge increase in the consumption of coal may mean for the global climate. A third revolution has to do with renewables and with technologies. I already referred to some of those, so I'll really dwell a little bit more on renewables, whose impact in the global energy mix is quite small. For example, solar today accounts for barely 1% of world electricity output, and that's despite a drop in the price of solar power per kilowatt hour of about 40 to 80%. Huge declines in the cost of solar and panels seemingly everywhere. less than 1%. But the trend lines for renewables and other smart, more efficient energy technologies are just momentous. And I think it's especially important, those trend lines driven not just or even not mainly by subsidies from governments, but increasingly by the market. The IEA projects that over the next two decades, nearly 60% of all new power generating capacity will come from renewables, will be in the renewables sector. The EU and this slide, which is an eye test currently, kind of shows a little bit of what some of these pieces are. The one up here, this is biomass. In the developed world, that would be waste, more or less. In the developing world, that would be trees. The blue is hydro. You can see it kind of bobs up and down. It's on an uptick in the last year or so. It goes up and down, of course, depending on the season. This one is interesting. Yellow is wind power. You can see starting from essentially nothing in 2008, it's become quite significant. The measure of trillion BTUs, complicated math, but that's important. Solar and geothermal, they're the ones that are down here, pretty small, pretty insignificant in the big scheme of things. The European Union set a goal in 2009 that 20% of its energy consumption should come from renewables by 2020. And just last year, 90% of the EU's new investment in the energy sector was in renewables. They're working hard to get this, and they're paying for it. Electric power in Europe is roughly twice what it costs in this country. Big investment costs. The companies and to some extent the government shouldering, adding to some of the political and economic headaches that the European Union has. And then there's China. A May 2000 headline in National Geographic, of all places, to me very succinctly described China's priorities. It read, the lead, three reasons to believe China's renewable energy boom. It has atrocious air pollution, it fears climate change, and it wants to be a manufacturing monster in renewables. It wants to grab that energy, that sector for itself. This chart speaks to the second of those pieces, the climate change priority. This line that goes up, that is CO2 emissions from China. As China builds new coal-fired plants, builds new oil-fired plants, builds new gas-fired plants, a huge increase, an utterly unsustainable increase, either for China's own atmosphere and the wealth and welfare of its citizens, to say nothing of the global environment. China aims to get 20% of its power from renewables by 2030, up from about 12% today. To get there, and to give you a sense of how they're working on this, the country in the year 2016 installed some 35 gigawatts of new solar generating capacity. I don't know exactly, I mean, I know what a gigawatt means, but I can't really picture that. A way to understand it, that 35 gigawatts is equal to the total installed capacity in solar in Germany today, installed in 1 year, all over China. Huge. As for the United States, Power County, I love that, it actually is a power county in Idaho. So about 10% of our overall energy consumption and about 15% of our electric comes from renewables, more than I thought. According to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, we produce more geothermal and biomass power than any other country. We're second in the world in wind, we're third in the world in hydro, we're fourth in solar. We're doing a lot in this sector, probably more than many people realize. The International Renewable Energy Agency projects that by 2030, the share of renewables in our energy mix could reach 27%. That would be 700 gigawatts, a more than six-fold increase over our current. That's a big number. The scale strikes me as unlikely given the current U.S. government's energy priorities. The stupendous investment costs associated with that, tens of trillions of dollars just in the United States to reach that goal. And also the matter of the relative energy abundance that I talked about to begin with. If oil and gas are relatively cheap, maybe it makes sense to work in this area, but there certainly are trade-offs for the companies that will be making the decisions. In both of these, in all of these areas pertaining to renewables, a takeaway though for the fossil fuel industries is they can't discount the possibility that there'll be a lot more progress in renewables than one might otherwise expect, because clearly renewables have moved much faster and much more subject to market forces than people might have expected. Getting renewables into our and the world's energy mix is a big, complicated deal. In every market, structural changes in how the power systems are designed and operated are required to accommodate renewables on any kind of a scale. And the reason is simple. Oil or wind and solar produce at varying levels, depending on whether it's day or night or the weather and so forth. And that's fine, except that users of the power grid expect to be able to throw a switch and have the power come on. And what that then requires smarter grids, different kind of grid management methods, and a quantum change in power storage. The long pole in the tent when it comes to renewables, especially in this country, especially in developed economies. Goldman Sachs, the investment firm, projects that demand for lithium used in rechargeable batteries and energy storage systems will triple by the year 2025. Those of you looking for investments, Australia, Chile, and Argentina, the major producers of lithium in the world, may become sort of super players in tomorrow's energy economy to accommodate all of that kind of growth. The fourth area I want to focus on, changing patterns of trade. And what this means is how the global energy system works in actual practice. One big set of trade-related changes comes in the area of natural gas. And what's happening there, as the IEA puts it, for the first time ever, a developing global market in gas. Now that may strike people in Congress, they've been trading gas for a long time. In yesterday's economy, the need for huge upfront investments, and especially fixed pipelines to get gas from point A to point B, meant that gas traded internationally according to long-term fixed contracts between producers and very specific buyers. The market, such as it was so narrow and stilted that prices were determined by the price of oil. The market in and of itself could not set gas prices. Today, an increasing share of international trade in gas is based not on long-term contracts, but done in the spot market. It's delivered not by pipelines, but by tanker. The spot market and ease of delivery, that makes for choice for consumers and producers. That's what we call competition. Competition that's now establishing a real price based on gas, and what's happening in gas prices on oil is falling away. Consumers that are locked into those long-term pipeline contracts, and I saw this in Turkey, are using this development to negotiate down the prices that they're paying in those long-term contracts because they don't make any sense. But now they have the leverage of the spot market to use as pressure. More importantly, previously inaccessible but potentially very profitable markets all around the world now abound for producers of gas in places like Argentina, Tanzania, Egypt, Australia, and the United States. And this will drive the development, drive the abundance of gas, and certainly at least the development of gas, further in the years to come. Second trade-related change comes in the Middle East, where decades of heavy investment in desalination, in electric power, in broader economic development have meant rising demand, which The IEA predicts will more than double in the next 20, 25 years, squeezing the exports that come from that part of the world. As a Middle East that's exporting less, or is less, whose exports are play a less, a smaller role in the overall energy trade and therefore the world economy, looms a little less large in the world than it used to. And indeed, that's led some pundits to pose provocative questions. If the Middle East is less important, or we're less reliant upon it for our economic well-being, can we or should we reconsider our defense and security posture and commitments in that part of the world? Or, given that Asia, and especially China and India, are going to become the ones most dependent on oil from the Middle East, why shouldn't they shoulder some of the security, political, and other burdens there? And how would that relate to American interests in that part of the world or and elsewhere? Finally, the most important market geopolitical terms, change in the pattern of trade comes, it has to do with Asia, which I spoke about a minute ago. That, and I'll explain this chart.
The dark blue down here is the total energy demand of the developed economies. That's the United States, Europe, Japan, a handful of others. The brown up here, that's total energy projected demand in 2040 in the developed world. You can see this is relatively stagnant, and this goes bonkers.
America's oil and gas industry got real interested in Asia. A few years ago, when the cost of energy in Asia was roughly three times what it was at that time in the United States, they saw tremendous opportunities to make a ton of money off the difference in those prices, a lot more money than they were making here. Others are in that same hunt today. Canada's Prime Minister recently approved a pipeline to the Pacific to market Canadian oil to Asia. Pipelines in Kazakhstan and Russia to China mirror this, as does the prospect of a pipeline from Central Asia down to India and Pakistan. Both countries starved for alternative energy supplies. Renewables are part of this too. Their developers and specialists in energy efficiency technologies also panting after markets, especially, of course, in China. My point in dwelling on that part of the world is that these countries will dominate future consumption and investment in energy. If one thinks of a market and the institutions that affect the market as a kind of governance, these countries are going to become much more central to the governance of the global energy economy. They will increasingly determine prices for oil and gas, what fuels and sources of power generation will grow and which will stagnate, the nature of relations between consumers and suppliers, whether the world can effectively arrest climate change or not. We can talk more about, I'm sort of getting there to the foreign policy side of things, and we can talk more about energy in the Q&A. But let me turn more explicitly to the foreign policy side. A former colleague of mine, Carlos Pascual, who now occupies an energy position at Columbia University, wrote recently that energy and geopolitics have always been closely linked. The 20th century saw access to energy resources become a major factor in determining the winners of wars, oil producers banding together to create new global alliances, and price swings that spurred or deterred the adventurism of superpowers. I want to illustrate some of what he was talking about with respect to Japan, the Arab oil boycott, U.S. energy policy in the former Soviet Union, and Iran, and then wrap up with North Korea, where some of these same energy issues are playing out very much today. So, Carlos's point, I think, is well illustrated out of this. And the decision by the Roosevelt administration in July 1941 to ban U.S. oil exports to Japan after its forces occupied Indochina. Japan at that time imported 90% of the oil that it consumed. 60% of the oil it consumed came from the United States, down from over 80% just a few years before. This was not a trivial matter. And just how not trivial it was, the Secretaries of State and the Navy opposed that decision on the grounds that it was tantamount to a declaration of war. It may well have been the right step in light of what of Japanese aggression. It was a very serious step, as history shows. In 1973, Arab member states of OPEC embargoed oil exports to the United States in retaliation for our decision to resupply the Israeli military during the Arab-Israeli war that took place that year. The price, to remind of the facts, the price of oil doubled and then quadrupled, imposing skyrocketing costs on consumers all over the world and huge structural challenges for nearly every economy in the world as they grappled with these big changes. America's policy response at the time wasn't always pretty. Most of us here will recall how much we liked the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit. We did create a Department of Energy to focus energy policy making in the U.S. government in a way that it hadn't been before. We established a strategic petroleum reserve to draw from when there were problems. And I read in the papers just the other day that reserve was drawn down quite in the last week or so in the aftermath of Hurricane Harvey. We began making serious R&D investments in energy technology and efficiency that's reflected in some of those developments that I talked about earlier. And we inaugurated this International Energy Agency that I referred to, which strategically was intended as a kind of developed consuming countries counter to OPEC and what OPEC represented. I might note that the Arab countries over time figured out that their tactics backfired, didn't work in their interests. And although there have been ups and downs with Middle Eastern countries in terms of oil supplies, that particular experience doesn't repeat itself. A third piece that I was personally involved in, Tim noted my service in Azerbaijan, followed the collapse of the Soviet Union. U.S. policymakers from Presidents Bush and Clinton on down gave a lot of attention to supporting the sovereignty and independence of the new states that emerged from the Soviet past. The premise, among other things, was that the USSR had represented the primary threat to our way of life for 40 years, that ensuring against its resurrection, therefore, was in our national interest, and the way to ensure it wouldn't be resurrected was for these states to succeed, stand on their own two feet. Oil and gas were a big focus of those efforts, especially in Central Asia and the Caucasus, which is especially in, say, Kazakhstan, which has big oil, largely over here, some over there, Turkmenistan, which has big gas, and Azerbaijan, which has oil, and is where the international oil industry really began in the late 1800s. These countries and other states' energy resources were seen as a godsend that could help them to stand up or directly to fund themselves new state institutions, new economies to provide some kind of a viable future for the country and for their own citizens. Of course, in that age, the 90s were the age of scarcity and concern about supply, so getting their resources to market was also seen as a good thing in and of itself, and arguably still is, insofar as these resources help, for example, our European allies diversify their sources of supply away from over-reliance on one source, and the one in particular would be Russia. So the whole story of this oil development out there is long and got many complications. I want to just highlight one piece. Pipelines. This will be another item. I don't want to explain all of this, but you can imagine the idea here. pipelines were essential to get the resources of these landlocked countries, none of them had a port on an international seaway, to get their resources developed. They had to be able to get that, to reliably get the product to market, to generate the funds to invest in the development of these fields. The existing pipelines were few, small in capacity, and went through Russia, which had no interest, really, in competition from these producers. There was another alternative, bringing the oil south through Iran to the Indian Ocean. Leaving aside our proclivities at that time with respect to Iran, and today for that matter, Iran's another competitor, not interested. Both Russia and Iran, on the contrary, interested in bottling up those energy resources, like forever. So we gave a great deal of backing to new pipelines that you can see here from the Caspian in the north and here to the Black Sea and to the Mediterranean. And then pipelines that go on, and I'm showing here, but that go on across, but across into Greece, into Southeast Europe, and Southern Europe for oil and for gas. Each involved many countries, each involved many governments, therefore, especially in the beginning, these were new governments that lacked a lot of competence or experience, any experience in these areas, also corrupt, complicating factor. And many private companies who were going to pay for this stuff. Big, tough business. It has largely been accomplished. And although there are plenty of things that have gone wrong in that part of the world, it's been good for American interests that Kazakh, Turkmen, and Azeri oil and gas got developed, that the pipelines necessary to bring that output freely to the international market were built, and that at least some rudimentary beginnings of statehood and stability of a sort have been created there. Fourth piece to turn to is Iran. Energy played an essential role in the diplomacy and strategy that led Iran to conclude the July 2015 Comprehensive Plan of Action that froze and partially unwound its nuclear weapons program. The prerequisite was UN Security Council consensus, the support of Russia and China, on a strategy to try to ward Iran away from that nuclear development effort. With that international consensus in hand and backed by measures that denied access to US and European financial markets for entities around the world importing Iranian oil, our diplomats were able to go to work. They convinced importers of Iranian oil, China, India, Southeast Asian countries, African countries, Latin American countries, to consider how over-reliance on Iranian oil made them vulnerable, put them at risk, and how we worked with them on how they could diversify their sources elsewhere, find other suppliers. As a result of that, of months and months and months of effort, every major importer of Iranian oil, every single one, cut purchases by 15 to 20%. They didn't cut them out altogether, but they cut them a lot. This and the 2014-15 collapse of international oil prices, remember there was a period when things got really cheap, at its peak, deprived Iran of some $5.7 billion a month in earnings. That's a lot of dough. That got Tehran's attention. It was essential leverage to get Iran to agree to constrain its nuclear program in return for sanctions relief. As probably most people in this room know, the Trump administration has proposed an international oil embargo on North Korea. On the premise, it's a little different than Iran, of course, on the premise that the North's near total lack of domestic energy resources would more or less force it to give up its nuclear program in order to get relief from that embargo. This may well be one of the lines on which the United States has got to try to work on the North Korean nuclear problem. But to succeed, it needs to be part of a comprehensive, multifaceted, sustained diplomatic strategy developed and pursued with many other countries in the world, and especially with Russia, with China and Russia. On the oil side, it will need to assess what are alternatives that North Korea has to its current supply arrangements, which are largely Russia and China, and how those alternatives can be brought into a consensus, and or how to raise the cost to North Korea of buying from those countries that we might not might prefer not sell at all. And of course, the strategy will also have to provide a way out for North Korea that addresses our most fundamental security concerns. We'll see how that develops. This leads to the last point that's a little bit more general in foreign policy than energy in nature. Whether the issue is North Korea, Iran, curbing greenhouse gas emissions, or nearly anything else that matters to the United States in the world, in the international arena, the essential pieces of statecraft almost always involve incisive, fact-based analysis, well-thought-out and comprehensive strategies that bring to bear all of the relevant instruments, all the necessary instruments of American power and influence, and strong and effective partners appropriate to the task, often including partners we don't like. To state it differently, statecraft in today's world means not just the deployment of a ship, or a telephone call, or a tweet, but serious strategies that relate to the problems as they are, to what it is we want to achieve, and the tools that we have or we can obtain in order to try to get what it is that we're trying to achieve. As Tim noted, I'm honored to have been part of a cadre of 4,500 or so officers who work in the U.S. Foreign Service. There's at least two others here, and maybe there's some others, three others here, and maybe some others in the group. The Foreign Service is a key part of the cadre of international affairs professionals. It includes our military and our intelligence agencies that has made American foreign policy competitive, effective, transformative, and incredibly successful over the last 70 plus years. The Foreign Service, our nation's diplomacy, and our foreign policy interests are being challenged today from within and without in ways that will have extremely negative implications for our country in the years to come. And those within parts are the ones that I hope people will think about a little bit. My remarks here are trying to highlight some of the complications, the complexities of the issues our country faces in the energy realm and how some of those have played out in our foreign policy, some of the complications associated with going down this or that path of response or approach to dealing with the problems and the issues we face, and the need for real strategies for diplomacy that is now kind of AWOL, and diplomats for advancing our country's interests and to the world. Thank you very much for your attention. So, Tim will be the vice chair of the question and answer committee, so please.
Thank you so much for your presentation. It was extremely interesting. Could you tell us a little bit more about how, working in Azerbaijan, you work to develop the pipelines, the challenges in both funding and logistics and infrastructure that you faced, and how those were addressed?
The major pipeline project that I was personally involved with in the 1990s in Washington, and then when I served in Baku, is what we call the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan main oil pipeline, large capacity pipe that runs from Baku to the Turkish Mediterranean.
It's this one. And the alternative at the time, the only alternative was this one that goes up through Russia, very close to Chechnya, not a very safe place. In fact, it goes through Chechnya, not a very safe place. Very small capacity, decrepit, and as I noted earlier, the Russians really had no interest in allowing very much because they're able to. The United States, working with Turkey especially, hit on this particular idea. And the Azeris were a part of that conversation. They loved this idea. Get the oil directly to the Mediterranean, not into the Black Sea. There's another pipeline that runs straight here, just to a port called Susa on the Georgian Black Sea coast. But that oil, to get out of the Black Sea, has got to go through the Turkish Straits, which are choked. That is very interesting for the 15 million people who live there to have a lot of tankers sailing through, and it isn't very it isn't a very robust way to move large quantities of oil. So everybody in government thought this was a great idea. BP thought it was a lousy idea. The oil companies thought it was a lousy idea. They wanted to just unload tankers at Supsa. Done. That's the end of the deal. And it took a lot of work to convince them that that the pipeline that they ultimately did agree to build was in their interest. And it really was a matter of convincing how and why it was in their interest, how they would make more money. That's what companies do. Why would it be advantageous to BP and to the other partners in the consortium that operates the oil fields are off the shore of the Caspian waters that belong to Azerbaijan. So that was probably the single biggest piece. And then just working week after week, month after month, to deal with the 1,001 problems that arose. Problems that arose, particularly Georgia, this Georgia vulnerable country. Its leader at that time, Edward Shevardnadze, repeated victim of attempts by Russian agents to assassinate him. Unstable. Really didn't control much of the country other than the capital. And today, of course, big chunks of northern Georgia occupied by Russian forces. So working with the Georgians, working with the environmental issues, because there are environmental impacts here. It's BP and its Western partners. You have to meet Western standards. The banks who will loan them the money to build this require environmental impact statements, even though Azerbaijan really didn't care. But the banks care. And therefore, the companies care, and the shareholders of BP care. I mean, it's sort of a broader thing. So, working through that set of issues, working through just day-to-day problems that came up in my personal piece, things that came up in Azerbaijan. For the 3 years I was there, I probably met with the president approximately every 2 weeks. And oil wasn't the only thing, or pipelines and oil and gas development wasn't the only thing at all. But it was big and tough business, very successful. And an illustration of this would be BP finally made the commitment to do this. Oil was trading at about $10 a barrel. They were very happy when oil went over $100. They were making a ton. And had a very advantageous deal in the structure that the governments had to agree to get the pipeline built was very advantageous for the companies. And as oil prices went up, it became even more advantageous. So, Tim?
I actually have two questions, but the first one, you said a while ago, I thought if I understood you correctly, that Arab policy backfired. I assumed you meant OPEC, which means Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
And because it really didn't begin to collapse until a year or so ago when Saudi Arabia no longer decided to be the balancer of the output. So I guess my question is, what do you mean when you said it backfired? My second question is, there were quite a few books written by experts like you in the 90s and early 2000s about how energy policy, our dependence on Middle East oil, was really driving our foreign policy, and we were probably at war in Iraq over oil. How do you sort of offset that with Germany, I think France, and England announcing a month or so ago that fossil fuel automobiles would be sort of out by 2030 or 2040. So where do you see energy policy? So I have, I guess, a couple of questions.
Okay. On the boycott piece, I think the point I wanted to make is that the Arab boycotters came to realize that beyond a certain point, their tactics failed to bring about the outcome that they sought, which was a change in U.S. policy with respect to Israel and somewhat later a change in our posture in the Middle East. And it also set in motion all kinds of things that were really not in their interest, like the development of a more robust energy industry in the United States, like the development of a big nuclear power industry in France, just to lower France's dependence on imported oil and oil from the Middle East, a diversion of a significant part of Europe's oil trading relationship from the Middle East to the Soviet Union and of course later Russia, which has its own geopolitical consequences, but diversifying resources, good idea, and so those were some of the consequences. And I think it's the result is that OPEC still exists. It's kind of hibernation today, clearly less adversarial over the last 15 or 20 years than it was in those early years in the 1970s and early 80s. When the time of the boycott and efforts that followed that to continue to try to jack up the prices in ways that ended up hurting their own economic interests and creating imbalances in the world, lowering growth elsewhere in the world, and therefore demand for their product, et cetera, et cetera. That's kind of what I was referring to. On your second point, I think one of the ideas that a lot of people and I'll be blunt, I think it's a misconception that a lot of people have, is that energy drives our foreign policy. And if you read in the Great Decisions book, and maybe some of you have gotten that, the article there actually begins with this statement that energy, I forgot the exact words, but essentially is a determinant of American foreign policy. As I think you might have gathered from the way I talked about specific foreign policy issues, it's actually the other way around. Our foreign policy interests have driven our energy, largely drive our international energy policy, whether it's cutting off oil to Japan or potentially North Korea to deal with a foreign policy problem, trying to promote energy development to help countries that are struggling to succeed, or cutting off the ability to sell in the case of Iran. The instrument was energy, but the purpose, the goal, was foreign in what was related to our broader foreign policy interests, priorities, goals, objectives, and the like. That may not always be the case when it comes to domestic U.S. policy. I'm less of a specialist on that, and probably a different conversation to have on the domestic side. And I'm sure you can point. One of the reasons why we're so involved in the Middle East is because of oil, of course. And oh, by the way, our economy kind of depends on it. And even if today only something like 12% of all imported oil to the United States, all oil imported to the United States comes from the Persian Gulf, 12% of our imports. So this is now like maybe 3 or 4% of our total consumption. If that were to go away, remember, markets operate at the margins. A marginal reduction of 3% or 4% or 5% here would have a significant impact. And oh, by the way, it would have a bigger impact on a whole bunch of economies that we depend on for our economic health and welfare. So anyway, it's kind of a long-winded answer, but I think my overall point is foreign policy drives energy. It's not the other way around.
There's reason to believe that wind, when coupled with storage, might take off faster than we're currently anticipating.
Yep.
One of the greatest things about renewable energy is that you don't need a grid to supply it. You can pick a city, stick up a wind turbine, you can supply energy to a couple hundred families in a hospital without ever having to build a grid. So what are the implications on the world stage if wind and solar, any renewable, takes off much faster than we're thinking it will, now that they're, you know, in fold-in storage, because we have storage available now too.
You're probably as good at predicting as I am. I think the further diversification of the global energy economy, the further diversification of specific energy economies in specific places, makes the whole system a lot more robust, a lot more interesting to make, maybe not giant pots of money that sometimes go with these huge resources, but very interesting money that then becomes a driver for those industries. That chart that I showed that had the yellow was wind. It has already grown much more rapidly than I think people would have predicted 10 or 15 years ago. The costs have come down quite a bit. There's been a lot of wind development in the places where there's a lot of wind, in this country especially. How much more growth there is, I don't know. That would, I think, be a question to ask. But certainly around the world, there is huge interest in countries, in governments around the world, in doing everything that they can to expand. Again, I saw that in Turkey, leasing places all over the country for potential wind farms. It's the same in Brazil. It's the same in Southeast Asia. And to the extent that market forces drive wind and solar, and not government subsidies, or not principally government subsidies, it will take off. And I think the evidence shows that it's already starting to, and that would be a great thing.
I'm lost.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, you've talked about a lot of the oil and oil-related energy sources. We have an administration that seems to think coal is going to have a comeback. Could you speak to that on a global level? How you see, is there any bigger future in coal that I'm not seeing right now?
No.
The picture is a little bit more complicated. I refer to India. Right. India currently gets something like 75% of its electricity from burning coal. And it's planning to triple its electricity output. How are they going to do that? That would be more coal. China, I don't know exactly what the percentage, I can't remember the percentage, but it's big. China is a big consumer of coal to produce electricity for its, you know, hundreds of millions of people. Coal is relatively cheap, it's abundant. It will continue to be part of the energy mix, along with oil and gas, for a long time. And in fact, the IEA, one of its conclusions, oil, gas, and coal together account for about 80% of global energy output, which is about the same level that oil, coal, and gas have accounted for like the last 70 years, or 60 years, long time. And they project that will continue for several decades, partly because developed economies maybe can afford some of these investments in renewables. India might be another matter. You know, they're struggling, people are struggling. Companies are small, their ability to raise capital limited, the amount of money they can charge for the power, maybe not what it is in developed economies. They don't have a lot of choice. But to cut to the chase, the IEA's projections are that coal demand globally will be flat. It won't increase on a global basis. It will continue to go down in the United States. It will continue to go down in Europe. But it will continue to rise elsewhere until displaced to some extent by natural gas is this gas revolution really gets going, and if there's unconventional shale gas that gets developed elsewhere, because China has similar deposits to ours, Argentina has similar deposits to ours, that can sort of supplant that. And of course, you've got renewables coming as well.
Thanks. Thanks, Mark. Thanks, Mark.
about the industry, but I did as a tourist in Lake Benton in Minnesota. And then two people I met through the University of Minnesota were going to go to Denmark to study more wind power. What percentage of that do you think you have in this state, wind power versus?
I couldn't give you a knowledgeable answer. Last month, my wife and I went down to see the eclipse. We drove down to central Nebraska, so through southwestern Minnesota, northeastern Iowa, and there is wind everywhere. It is big, big business. But what percent that is, I don't, maybe somebody does. It's not insignificant.
18
for the state as a whole.
Yeah.
Well, that's more than I thought. That's above the national average.
Yeah, it's way above.
Yeah.
Excel's a leader in that.
I just wanted to reinforce, I think, that the pace of change towards renewables is going to accelerate for some things like the electrification of the transportation sector. I think it also accelerates when we have these climate shocks, and we're seeing, you know, over the last several weeks that the electrical system in particular, but also the fuel sector, is really pretty brittle and pretty susceptible to these shocks. And since a lot of these markets are driven by consumer demand, when the consumer sees that, I think that it's creating an opening here for, I think, a more rapid acceleration. I actually have a question about trade. The International Trade Commission is going to issue a finding a week from Friday that would potentially support a significant tariff on the import of solar panels. All imported panels, not just China, other countries as well. However, China is going to be the biggest loser from that. Not to mention it probably means a couple of 100,000 jobs in the solar energy industry. We need China's help right now on a major foreign policy issue. And you know, my question is really, you know, how far do we push them, and when do we get to the point where China says, "Fine, you want our help on North Korea, then lay off on some of these protectionist tariffs in a major sector that we're trying to promote."
Let me comment first on your comments. I largely agree that the market dynamics of renewables are very favorable, and I think growth is clearly occurring faster in this country and in Europe than people would expect. Oil will remain important. For example, there are very few alternatives to oil in fuel transport, in aviation, in petrochemicals. Three big industries growing all around the world. Big source of growth. In fact, those three sectors, according to the IEA, but that's where the growth, to such as it is, both in the developed world and to some extent even in the developing world, the growth and demand for oil will take place in those three areas. There's also a problem of inertia. Power, the big power industries, not the local stuff, but the big power companies, the big expensive systems that get used a long time before they come out of service. So for those reasons, plus the costs of associated with big renewables, not the local stuff, but a big transition to renewables, the IEA puts the figure something like $40 trillion. That's a lot of dough. And that's required to fully transform systems to work with renewables and the batteries and the storage and the this and that and the grid. That will take time, and I agree things are going fast, but there will continue to be significant demand for it. On your point about solar panels, I don't know how that decision is going to come out. I know there was a piece in the New York Times here 4 months ago, American solar panel producers basically being creamed by Chinese producers who can hugely undercut the sort of prices that the American firms can offer. The ITC, I dealt a little bit with it when I was a trade negotiator. They have pretty strict economic and statistical criteria that they use. Politics not really supposed to be part of the deal. they make a recommendation. It makes a recommendation to the administration that has to decide what to do, and we'll see kind of how that comes out. From what I said on the foreign policy side, I think it's, I'd add that it's essential that governments, that governments in general and ours in specific, be conscious about the trade-offs that we have with other countries, conscious about the impact of labeling China a currency manipulator. Candidate Trump said he was going to do that as president. He has kind of shied away from that. The consequences of slapping high tariffs on Chinese steel, conservative on that front as well, on the solar panel front. What you do over here has consequences over there, and sound government policy kind of thinks those pieces through. The one that's even more outrageous to me, the South Korean free trade agreement. President, the administration clearly dumping all over that in public and calling out for it to be ripped up. At a time when that ally is under direct threat from North Korean nuclear weapons, maybe that agreement should be renegotiated. Maybe it was a bad idea. I don't know. Is now the time? Or is now the time when allies kind of coalesce together to deal with the critical national security problem? And that's where I hope the Trump administration can find some sensible ways. They're not succeeding in that area to date. Our diplomacy on the North Korea nuclear program in particular is kind of AWOL. Our diplomacy with respect to China is kind of AWOL. And that's not good for our interests in the world. It's not good for solving some of these problems that are extremely important for the kind of world we live in.
Hey, so a millennial question, but so I see Russia making overtures to Turkey, given this pipeline here. What happens if Turkey decides that they want to kind of leverage their relationship with Russia against us, and how do you overcome that?
Well, Turkey's clearly leveraging the relationship with Russia in ways, among other things, intended to irritate the United States. I think pipelines has virtually nothing to do with it. Turkey imports like 75% of its energy. It made a strategic decision in the early 1990s to move away from heavy reliance on coal, which was producing acute environmental problems for the country, in favor of natural gas. And the natural gas that was on offer at that time was mostly Russian. And so very heavy, you know, they're not reflected here, but there's a pipeline that comes down from Russia across to Turkey. There's another line that goes around through Ukraine that supplies gas to Istanbul or the Istanbul area. That's absolutely critical for Turkish interests. But at the same time, Turkey is very much a partner in this pipeline that runs directly contrary to Russia's interests. And in another line that sort of parallels it up to here and then keeps going that way, that's going to bring very large volumes of Azeri and potentially also Turkmen gas into markets in Europe that now gas markets largely belong to Russia. So Turkey's playing a lot of games. It's trying to make money out of this stuff. It's trying to position itself to be a central player, to be a hub, sort of, in the energy world, and also to supply the energy needs of its economy and further diversify away from sources that, you know, kind of don't work.
Hi. What would it take for global governments to reconsider non-weaponized nuclear energy?
Nuclear actually is poised for some pretty dramatic growth in China. China has dozens, I believe, maybe many dozens of nuclear power plants on the drawing board. That's also part of their push to move away from coal that's killing the people and all the problems that sort of go along with it. If there are other countries that are doing much in the nuclear realm, I'm not really aware of it. We get around, I think it's around 20% of our power, our electric electricity comes from nuclear. That's been a relatively flat rate. There were, at least a couple of years ago, plans for in the works for new nuclear power development, in part because of more interesting opportunities and easier opportunities in the renewables area. Because of all this stuff going on in gas, where there's a lot of money to be made, companies kind of not really interested. The nuclear plants here get operated by electric utilities. They've got other ways, easier ways, less troublesome ways to get their power. And I don't think that's going to change. And I don't think that's principally a reflection of public attitudes toward nuclear power, the political problem of nuclear power. I think it's the complexity, the difficulty, and the long-term question marks about liabilities that are out there that just aren't as interesting as other ways that the companies have to make money.
But didn't you say France is entering?
France developed, beginning I think in the 1980s, a big nuclear power industry. They operated. It's not growing, as far as I know. Germany, actually going quite the opposite direction, also developed a not quite as large, but a robust nuclear sector, decided 3 or 4 years ago after Fukushima into that. And so they're shuttering all those plants, and that's part of the reason why they're pouring a lot of money into renewables, because they got to have, they need energy for their economy. It's got to come from someplace.
Hi. Could you speak a little to the Paris Climate Accord and one administration signed up for it, the next dropping out, maybe the potential for the next one to want to get back in, and kind of what that is?
Yeah, I kind of omitted, as you obviously noticed, from the prepared remarks, but very much about the Paris Climate Accord, because I don't know all that much about it and the details of it. I'll speak to a couple of issues. For one thing, all the targets and goals and objectives that countries made in those agreements are voluntary. It's a statement of intent, not a set of commitments. That created question marks. There were legitimate questions to ask, I think, about what's the point in our going to the expense and the trouble to meet our requirements if a lot of others, and maybe a lot of other big and important players, like, say, India and China, China is working hard, but India less. So they got commitments and they have no intention of making, of abiding by them. And I think that's a point of controversy. There is this matter that I think that I'm losing my train of thought here. For better or worse, President Obama didn't have a strong consensus in Congress behind that agreement. You can argue about whether that's good or bad or wise or unwise. The fact is, there was not a substantial consensus in the Congress to go down that road. That's what happened. So what the Trump administration has done in walking away is one of the things that happens when the executive makes a set of decisions that aren't either rooted in law that Congress has passed or a treaty that Congress has passed, or at least in a reasonably robust bipartisan consensus behind that set of policies. And I think it's unfortunate, including that we walked away, including because they're voluntary. And we, in effect, absent ourselves from the further conversations about what to do about greenhouse gases. And that's, for a whole variety of reasons, that's not in our interest. One of the pieces that I worked my way through in preparation for this talk and others that I'm giving on this subject is something called the World Energy Outlook Report that the International Energy Agency puts out. They did did analysis in the immediate aftermath of the Paris Accords of what would be the cost, what are the specific things that have to happen in order for each of the 100 plus countries that signed the agreement to meet the commitments that they talked about, and it's quite interesting and dense reporting. Among other things, they concluded that if all those countries did all those things, the world would fall well short of the goal for containing the rise of global temperatures, the 1.5% increase in the centigrade that they were intending to try to address. And so the latest report by IEA tries to say, okay, what would it take to go significantly further than those international commitments? And that was this $44 trillion bill for production and infrastructure, plus another $30 trillion in energy efficiency improvements that have got to be made all over. That's a lot of money. And the world economy is a big thing. I think the world economy totally is something like $60 or $70, $80 trillion. So there's a lot of, over time, this is a doable thing, but it's going to take quite a while. And I think those price tags are also kind of a reason why the consensus didn't build around this. Although I think there is pretty broad consensus, notwithstanding some, of course, that climate change is happening and that it owes, at least among other things, to the immense amount of greenhouse gases that are being pumped into the atmosphere. Having said all that, I'm not an expert, I'm sorry.
But it's speak a little more directly because I know it's kind of central to this.
It would appear that the Department of Energy is in shambles and even worse than the State Department at this point, but when you were negotiating something like this, what was the interaction that the State Department and the Department of Energy would have had? How did they assist you? Were they involved as you were in negotiations with the pipeline that you're showing the board?
During the Clinton and early Bush, the first years of the Bush administration, there was little Energy Department involvement, except at the top. Secretary of Energy, Secretary Richardson, Secretary Abraham, they kind of got this, and they understood the importance, the geopolitical importance of what we were trying to do, and that their presence at ceremonies to open the pipeline, their going to meet with foreign leaders to talk through where there were problems and be part of the solution to those problems. So that was important. That sent a signal, among other things, to the countries that we were serious, to the Russians that we were serious, and that they needed to not mess around too much. But at the staff level, it was very much. That changed by the Obama administration created an Assistant Secretary for International Affairs, very heavily involved in the work that went on at that time for this gas pipeline that I referred to Southeastern and Southern Europe. I don't know what the picture is today. Throughout the State Department, there are dozens of most of the policy positions are vacant. So I don't know exactly who it is that can do this diplomacy, and I don't actually know the situation at the Energy Department. It's hard to imagine that it's better, or significantly better, but I don't really know. But in practice, there's work together. At the end of the day, to come back to a point I made earlier, a lot of this stuff is about foreign policy. Energy is the instrument. The Energy Department has energy policy. And yes, they're involved in the international side, but the drivers end up being state, the National Security Council, the president.
Ross, our current top diplomat, Secretary of State Tillerson, has a very strong background in the energy industry. How do you think that experience, that background, will inform and guide our country's foreign policy with regard to these energy issues, for better or for worse, in the years ahead?
The honest answer is beats the hell out of me. it has to be helpful that Secretary Tillerson understands. He's got a lot of relationships around the world. He understands a lot about a lot of countries around the world, and he understands energy markets. So when they start talking about an embargo on North Korea, he knows a lot more than most people. Most of the other folks in the State Department, well, what questions to ask? at least insofar as you're talking about energy companies, about energy flows, the trade, and that sort of stuff. And that ought to be helpful, I mean. The problem is that Secretary Tillerson has less experience in public policy or international affairs, as politics, and the stuff that goes along with that, than any Secretary of State in maybe 100, 150 years, maybe ever. Maybe ever. Every Secretary of State, if you go back, virtually all of them, they were senators sometimes, they were members of Congress, they were an ambassador someplace, they were an assistant secretary of state, or maybe the treasury, they were someplace. And, you know, what we do in government is a rocket science, but on the other hand, it helps to have some experience, and he's lacking in that. He has been unsuccessful in pushing through lieutenants to help him work out the details and then do the diplomacy with foreign leaders. Because the Secretary of State's got a million things to do and not very, only 24 hours in a workday. And I think it's those pieces that are holding back, among other things. Those are the key pieces that are holding back American diplomacy and creating all kinds of problems that will just get worse with frightful implications when you think about this kind of.
Well, I think we've reached the conclusion of our program this evening, and Ambassador Wilson, thank you so much for your.
Thank you.